Hi, I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for February 10th, 2017. This is a podcast about creativity through music featuring the performers you hear each weekend on the radio and online at WCRB. What you're hearing is part of J.S. Bach's Mass in B Minor, which we broadcast live on the radio last Saturday night from Symphony Hall. Andras Nelsons led the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, along with soprano Malin Christensen, mezzo-soprano Christine Rice, tenor Benjamin Bruns, and bass baritone Hanno Müller-Brockmann. It's a performance that's now available to hear on demand, and it's also part of the BSO Concert Channel, which is a continuous stream of concert performances. You'll find it all at our website, classicalwcrb.org. And you can also hear from the new director of the Tanglewood Festival Chorus, James Burton, on last week's podcast. Also on last week's podcast, you heard Ian Bostridge talk with me about Schubert's Winterreise, as well as a conversation among violinist Isabel Faust, pianist Alexander Melnikov, and my colleague Kathy Fuller. Their performance of two Beethoven violin sonatas and Ian Bostridge's Winterreise are also available on demand at the website classicalwcrb.org. Just look for In Concert. And before we leave last week behind entirely, I just want to bring you one more small part of Bach's B minor Mass. One of the real pleasures of producing BSO concerts for me personally is hearing a lot of music I worked on as a performer. I made my living as a trumpet player for many years, and as I did auditions with various orchestras, it wasn't uncommon to find a particular excerpt from the B minor Mass among the parts that audition committees wanted to hear. It's near the beginning of the second half of the piece, in the credo section, and part of what makes it such a test for the first trumpet player is that it's all alone. The other trumpets don't play, and neither does the timpani, which is the case for just about everything else in the Mass. That sets it up to be a bit nerve-wracking already. But then, what Bach wrote is just so crazy. It includes a wide range, it veers outside the typical notes of the D major scale that the rest of the part stays in, and it takes an enormous amount of just sheer breath control. Oh yeah, and it also ends on one of the higher notes the trumpet is ever asked to play. So with all that in mind, take a listen to BSO principal trumpeter Tom Rolfs as he plays it. You actually have to listen a little carefully because he's so relaxed as it begins. And there you have it. It's never really a surprise when the individual players of the BSO pull off amazing solos, but it's just continually striking how easy they can make it sound. Again, you can hear the entire Mass in B minor with Andras Nelsons conducting at classicalwcrb.org. This week, the BSO program will broadcast live on Saturday night, begins with Ravel's Le Tombeau de Couperin and ends with the Symphonie Fantastique by Berlioz, both works that the BSO really owns. And in between is a BSO co-commission called Dream of the Song by George Benjamin. In just a bit, you'll hear about the program a little bit more from Andras Nelsons. First, though, I have a preview of Sunday's 7 p.m. broadcast of WCRB in Concert with the Boston Chamber Music Society. It's an all-Dvorak program, and Kathy Fuller talked with violist and artistic director Marcus Thompson and violist Dmitry Murat. Here's Kathy.
I just want to know first, Marcus Thompson, when you're on stage and deep in a great piece of chamber music for three or four or five people, what do you hope happens in the audience?
Well, I hope they notice how much we love what we're doing, how much we love doing it with one another. And, of course, we hope that they deeply enjoy the music, because all the music we play is really great music.
Dvorak is suddenly beloved. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think that's why we programmed him, because, I remember the days at the Boston Chamber Music Society when people would call to cancel their subscription because they thought Dvorak was a modern composer. They didn't realize that he was, beloved and promoted by Brahms, that he was very close to his roots, his native Czech roots, both in the Czech Republic, or what was the Czech Republic, before it became the Czech Republic, and also close to his fellow countrymen who had immigrated to the United States. And all of those things together, he's someone who managed to go to the greatest heights as a composer and still remember his humble roots.
Dmitri Murat, Dvorak was a violist, wasn't he?
Yes, he started out playing as a violist in the opera house in what is now Czech Republic. At the same time, what was at first his hobby became his real profession, which was, of course, being a composer. He was a very romantic person. One of the pieces in the program that we played is called The Cypresses, which he wrote first when he was quite young, in his early 20s, and which he then went back to at the end of his life and rearranged them for string quartet. And it's a very interesting piece because the songs were written about a love interest that he had as a young man. And in the end, it didn't work out with that love interest. And he married that lady's sister. But then at the very end of his life, one of the very last things he went back to was those very songs and rewrote them for string quartet. I feel very close to Dvorak on a very personal level. I find his music to be extremely personal to me. And in the same way as Schubert, I find that there's a lot of relation between Dvorak and Schubert in the harmony, in the emotional language. And so, yeah, it came very naturally. I actually don't remember how I came across those pieces.
They're so full of love, kind of, and with that nice romantic tradition of it being slightly hidden, but there is this passion in there, right?
Well, the words, well, we don't get to say the words. I guess we put them in the program or something like that. But it's a little bit embarrassing, you know, in terms of the way we express our sentiments today. But Dmitri's right. It's very personal. It's like a personal love letter. And, you know, you look like feel like you're eavesdropping or, you know, looking into someone's personal mail.
I think it was the cellist Tanya Tetzlaff told me recently that whenever she plays Dvorak, even the kids in the audience kind of get it and love it. She says it's something she has always noticed. Do you feel that the audience kind of really connects with you?
Well, there are two things. There are so many beautiful melodies. Even Brahms said that he wished that he could write melodies as beautiful and as memorable as Dvorak did. And also, just in terms of the way the pieces are constructed, I think Dvorak is the ultimate crowd pleaser. He really knows how to stir up an audience, you know, either through repetition and getting louder and more exciting. He seems to understand all the rules of the craft when it comes to that. Of course, you can say that about any composer, but for him, you can almost look at it and say, well, I see what he's doing here. Sort of like the wrong analogy, sorry, is the horror movie, you know, where everything is very calm and you say, uh-oh, something really bad is about to happen. In his case, he just knows how to set you up, and of course, you're right with him. You love it that he set you up in that way, and you just go for the ride. And so, you know, he writes the best endings and he writes the best calm music. One of the lovely things about the quintet that we play at the end of the program is this beautiful tuneful hymn that he uses as the basis for a number of variations. And it's just the kind of him that, you know, what anyone would recognize, except that you don't recognize. He composed it. He seems to know how to do that and call you into the center of that, and then write the most incredible, beautiful variations. And of course, after you've heard this hymn, you're singing it the rest of the day, and you can follow along through the piece as to, you know, how it's treated in an expert way by a real master. So you're really drawn into it.
Tell me about the terzetto. And you always read, it's almost funny. You look up a piece by Dvorak, and it always somewhere says, dashed off in 6 days, or, 13 days was all it took, And yet there's so much there. Tell us about this piece.
Oh, well, it's one of the first pieces that comes to mind that doesn't have a cello. Terzetto is three players and two violins and viola. So it's sort of like the equivalent of the Andrews Sisters. There are that sense of close harmony and close rhythmic movement together that you like in popular trios, vocal trios like that, you get in this music. And, of course, you get everything else that Dvorak has, the ability to write nice endings, the real ability to write beautiful melodies. And a scherzo movement, the third movement, is a kind of furiant, a dance that he employed a lot in his chamber music where, everything just gets very, very exciting. And so it's a favorite of a lot of people, and not only just because there isn't a cello in it. I mean, we wish he had a cello. Of course, he wrote many great string quartets, but there's something special about the closeness of the harmony.
There's also something about this piece with the kind of colors that he managed to get out of just those three instruments. I think because there is no cello, he can focus on the more treble range of pitches, and he makes those three instruments sound like some other folk instruments from his native land.
The quintet that ends the program, you say it's got this spirit of folklore.
Yes.
How does he get that? What does he do specifically? Can you take us through it?
This was something which I learned a lot when I first came to America. I'm originally from Belgium, and when I first came to America, it was to do a seminar with the Emerson String Quartet on Dvorak's quintets. And one of the pieces was this viola quintet, the American viola quintet. So we had a lot of seminars learning how Dvorak really wanted to incorporate elements of American folk music, or the original American music, into his music. And he really went a different route than people wanted him to go. They really wanted him to include a lot of English tunes and German tunes. And actually, he went against that. He wanted to include more of the African-American spirituals, some of the Native American music, and also some of the Irish music. And so he put those elements in this piece, and it makes it have a much different flavor. I think he did a great service to American music and to world music.
That's violist Dmitri Murat, a member of the Boston Chamber Music Society, and you also heard from Marcus Thompson, the artistic director of the Chamber Music Society, both of them with my colleague Kathy Fuller. The Boston Chamber Music Society is on the air this Sunday at 7 o'clock on WCRB in concert. And for more information about the program, head to our website, classicalwcrb.org. Tomorrow night at 8 p.m., we'll bring you another Boston Symphony concert live from Symphony Hall. The program includes Ravel's Le Tombeau du Couperin, George Benjamin's Dream of the Song, and Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. And when I met with Andras Nelsons at the hall, I asked him if the main connection is simply the way that each of those pieces is built around a really exquisite use of orchestral color and texture.
That's a kind of obvious connection, to the texture, the sound, and the color, and the of the organism of the sound, Let's say a sound analyzed from the Germanic perspective, so the rich sound. Okay, you have the lines, and then you have combinations, and so if you think of Bruckner or and the Wagner, and then you come to this texture, which is Ravel, Berlioz, Mr. Benjamin, that importance of the structure of sound, I would say of the X-ray of sound. You could say the X-ray. You see this very, very intimately, and you can see, there's little, each instrument has a ECG, you can see that kind of sensitivity, I think it's...
Or EKG.
EKG, yes. And that sensitivity, that kind of sensitivity of sound and structure of sound is like a nickname for this program, I would say. And therefore, it's so interesting to put this kind of from one side, very so many things in common composers, but from the other side, they're also very different, and different, you know, periods and about different themes somehow emotionally, but representing through this kind of sound idea, but the different problematics, you know. It's very interesting to, and of course, with Boston Symphony, I have such a great tradition of French music playing. I have done a lot of Symphony Fantastique, but I always afraid doing it, because this is one of these pieces where it also proves, I think, that you can perform and should perform music, whatever music you perform, only with the attitude, the sensation and what is needed in each concert, and it should be 100%. But I believe it in all music, but this is one example which is very, very clearly says so. If you just play notes and just, it does not satisfy your expectations, but it immediately, if you put your emotional sensitivity, that the piece is alive.
That's Andres Nelsons, and you can hear him lead the Boston Symphony Orchestra live on the radio tomorrow night, beginning at 8 p.m. For more details, visit classicalwcrb.org. And now for a bonus interview. Several years ago, countertenor Andreas Scholl came to town for a concert presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston, and it was just after he had released a recording of solo cantatas by Bach. So I got together with him at New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall, and I asked him why, in spite of the very specific circumstances Bach wrote them for, these cantatas remain so relevant and powerful today.
I think that has to do with the conviction of the composer. I think if you hear this music, you hear that it had a special purpose, and that Bach wanted to fulfill this mission at any price. So it's not primarily meant to entertain in the lighter sense of the meaning, but yes, to entertain, but to move and educate the human soul. And I think every composition that is based on that principle, that it really tries to strike a chord within the innermost part of the listener, that music will be relevant, was relevant 200, 300 years ago, and will be relevant in another century as well.
You write in your notes for this recording that the knowledge of the religious background and belief can be as much a help as it can be an obstacle. How is the knowledge of the religious belief and background an obstacle in this music?
It can be an obstacle if you forget your role as a singer. My role is primarily communicator. So if I sing for anybody's enlightenment, I sing for the audience's enlightenment. It's not about me being moved, me having an epiphany on stage, but it's, if anything should happen, it should happen to the audience. And I've seen one particular moment as a student, a female colleague, a soprano, who we knew was very religious, and she sang something on stage and it estranged the audience, because we could see that something was going on with her, but it was very egoistic of her, because she sang for her own enlightenment in a concert, and she obviously had some kind of dialogue with God in that moment, which I congratulate her for, but the problem is that she completely forgot that her purpose of being there was not for her own enlightenment, but even if you see it in the context of God, who has given her the voice, he does not want her to exclude the audience from that experience. So being religious might lead to misunderstandings about how you present it and who the music was meant for. It's not meant for the singer or for the musicians themselves, but the singers and the musicians are channels, are communicators of a deeper message that is meant to reach the audience.
By the same token, does it help, or is there an obstacle even for the audience in knowledge of that religious background and belief?
Of course, I think as a singer and in an early music context, thinking about the words, the meaning of the words, and understanding the meaning of the words, text and context. Of course, I need to know what it is all about. I remember working with a student, and most listeners might not believe it. I worked on a Bach solo cantata. It was a young countertenor. And I said, well, you know, it's all very nice, beautiful singing, but I lack some kind of, I want to hear something personal, some conviction, something that you're preaching to the audience. So let's try to simulate that. And I said, well, you understand, it's a sermon. And he didn't respond to the word sermon. I said, well, but you know that music has been written, this music has been written for a specific Sunday, and there would be, it would refer to a certain gospel. And at the word gospel, he didn't react. And then I said, well, you know, the New Testament. And he didn't react to that. He didn't know anything. He came from a different culture. So he was obviously not raised within a Christian tradition, or a tradition that at least knows about Christianity and Jesus and the New Testament, the gospel. So, of course, how can he give any meaning to this music? I'm sorry to say so, just by sound and phonetically reproducing the sounds of the words. The words want to be connected with the meaning, and therefore, of course, if I know something about the context, I can extract much information from the context and the text, the words, in order to get to a convincing performance.
And you say that, especially in the recitatives, it's important to say the words beforehand, before you start to sing, and that you find that there is maybe, if I might interpret your words, more flexibility or more to find interpretively in the recitatives than in the arias, maybe.
Absolutely. I think we know that the essence of what happens, for example, in the St. John's Passion, it's the essential words are being spoken by the choir and the chorale, the kind of contemplation, and the evangelist in the recits tells the story. The arias are just contemplative moments where the singer picks one element of the whole subject that he thinks about, and he repeats the words over and over. And in the recit, we really have the condensed message as it should be, and the recit offers much more freedom than we think. The recit itself, of course, is printed in music, and we have pauses, and we have quavers, semi-quavers. So, of course, primarily we just would need to sing. But I think in that sense, since it's a recit and it comes from the spoken word, the idea is to inject as much spoken word as possible and follow the art of rhetorics, how to make a speech, how to surprise an audience. And if you made the point, you don't continue directly with the next phrase, but you wait and let it sink in. If there's something important, you spread the words a little bit because you think it's important. Well, as I do now, and you can do exactly the same in a recit, and that elevates the recit from sight reading it to meaning it and speaking it.
Do you recommend to listeners that they maybe pay a little bit more attention to recitatives than maybe a lot of them do?
Certainly. I mean, I know for the music lovers who go for the melodies and the beautiful harmonies, the recits are mere transition to the next beautiful moment in music. Let's finish that quickly in order to arrive at the next aria. But of course, that's not how it's meant, because then, especially in Bach's music, the recits have so much meaning. And it's like, to me, a Bach recit is like a crossword puzzle. It's something that you can return to over and over, and you think, today, maybe I try this. And you come back to it and you say, last week I thought that was a good idea. Today I'm not so convinced. And then over many days that you repeat it over and over, even maybe weeks or months, you accept new ideas, you discard old ideas, and eventually you arrive at something that for that moment in time is something that you can really communicate to the audience with conviction. Then, of course, over the years, your ideas might change. But at least for the moment, you arrived at a point where you say, yes, this is how I think it's meant.
Your new recording has many wonderful things in it, but two complete cantatas, the cantatas numbers 82 and 169. How did you settle on those two to feature in this recording?
Well, first, what I would recommend everybody is to find the gospel that was written for that specific Sunday. And in the internet age, you just Google, I don't know, third Sunday after Trinitatis, and you find the gospels that could be read. And of course, you instantly will find the gospel that Bach comments on. And in the cantata, Gott soll allein mein Herz haben, is the dispute between Jesus and the Pharisees. What is the most important rule, the most important commandment? And he says, well, it's thou shalt honor your God, but it's also thou shalt love thou your neighbor. And that's the gospel of that day. So it says, God alone should have my heart. And the other cantata is beautiful cantata, Ich habe genug, I have enough. And of course, sometimes you hear it being sung as if I have enough of this world, I want to leave. But it's not meant like this. It's meant I have enough, I don't lack anything. And that refers to the old man Simeon, who knew the prophecy that before he would die, or he would not die until he would see the Messiah, the Savior. And then in the temple, the Virgin Mary arrives with the baby Jesus, and Simeon realizes this is the moment. And then he says these famous words, Nun lässt du Herrn dein Knecht. I don't know the exact translation in English, but he says, well, Lord, now I may go because I have enough. I have seen everything. This holding the baby Jesus fulfills my life. I'm happy with everything I have here. Nothing keeps me in this material world, one could say, my soul can be freed. And that's what that cantata is about. And of course, it helps a lot to know that this is what it's about, yeah? About leaving the world behind, which is a constant subject in Bach's music. It's always the world against the coming new life, the life with God in the non-material world. Yeah.
Do you feel like today's world looks at reality that way, or are we talking about music from a completely different world view?
Certainly. I think we have many new age ideas that in a way come back to the way people saw it in Bach's time, although from a different perspective. The idea that what we have here, material things, are imperfect. Everything will perish. Everything will be gone. This table, the sofa I'm sitting on, the building, just add a few hundred thousand or a few million years, nothing lasts forever. So the material world is imperfect. And there must be something that is perfect, something to strive for. The afterlife, as in some other traditions it's called, or what the Christians believe, resurrection of the soul, which is the immaterial thing, that lasts forever. And because if we only see the purpose of art and music in a simple form of entertainment, in a sense of distraction, that, well, for a moment I don't think about anything else, that's something already, I would say, but that's not enough. I think the deeper meaning will fulfill itself in a much more beautiful way if we realize that music might take us away from things that we worry about, put them into the right perspective, take them away from us for a moment, the duration of a concert, and afterwards we have a different perspective, so that the arts and music is a way of educating the soul and not only distracting us, but teaching us.
One final thought. You have told others in the past that the music business, what you do for a living, can be very, very hard on someone's soul, maybe, mm-hmm. that there's a way in which you become isolated. Only you become maybe cocooned in an insular world, and that affects not only yourself as a person, but even your musical interpretations. Mm-hmm. You're on a tour right now. How do you keep yourself connected to human experience in those ways that people live their lives so that you can interpret music for them?
I think it's always important to strike the right balance. The tendency, of course, is on a tour to get this tunnel vision. You live only from concert to concert, and you're over-concerned about your vocal health, like, oh my God, I might catch a cold. And then you're kind of directed by your fears rather than by the joy for the next concert. And I think what's important, since music reflects life, my singing should reflect life. It's about human weaknesses, it's about jokes, about funny things in a song recital. Maybe it always reflects and comments life. So if I don't have a real life, what am I supposed to sing about? So and therefore I think it's important to have enough family moments, moments with friends, quality time with my daughter, for example, who will come next week to New York, because I will stay on Monday. I start rehearsing at the Metropolitan Opera. So it simply needs a strategy and a discipline in planning these moments, like saying, okay, I will be away for such a long time. I ask my daughter and my ex-wife, who's a good friend now, and I always invite them to where I am, and they're happy to travel and come and see New York. And so these are important moments. Otherwise, you kind of isolate yourself. I would say this real isolation comes over the years, when you only live with people who have to do with music, when you're only surrounded by people who tell you how wonderful you are, and then it might have a negative influence on your character, because you forget that you're surrounded by human beings, that you need to be patient with fellow musicians. If they don't instantly get your genuine idea of a piece, because they have maybe different ideas that are as right as your idea are, and then it just needs patience, understanding with your fellow human beings, and that might be lost if you put standards always with yourself and you're constantly surrounded by people who tell you you're the greatest and the best.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Andreas Scholl.
You're most welcome.
You can hear countertenor Andreas Scholl on the Bach Hour when you visit classicalwcrb.org. That's where you'll also find the latest episode of The Answered Question. You can subscribe to this podcast at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you'll also find it at WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud pages. Thank you to all the guests on this podcast, including Marcus Thompson, Dimitri Murat, Andres Nelsons, and Andreas Scholl. Thanks also to the staffs of the Boston Chamber Music Society, the Boston Symphony Orchestra, and the Celebrity Series of Boston for making these conversations possible. And thanks as well to my colleagues at WCRB, Kathy Fuller and Alan McClellan. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.